listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a very special guest, storyboard artist, singer, songwriter, and filmmaker, Mr. Jeffrey Henderson.
Thanks for having me, man.
What else can I add to that resume? It's crazy, man.
I've been out of stripping for a while, so I don't know if that counts. But, you know, I always try to leave that door open just in case.
You have a lot of credits. It means you're a multi-talented artist on all levels. Do you have a favorite?
Boy, that's a good question. I think if I had a gun in my head and I had to pick, I would probably identify myself as a musician first, I think.
That's awesome.
Partly because it's, I think, not just creatively, but personally, and I don't want to get like pretentious about, but like, you know, existentially, spiritually, like it looms very large in my life, and I don't ever remember a time in my life that music hasn't been the centerpiece in one way or another.
Yeah.
And particularly, like, there's a story, a lot of my friends know this, but I have a story. I had a terrible accident when I was a little kid.
Oh.
And it's all right. In a weird way, it's actually kind of a good thing, because I kind of jokingly refer to it as my superhero origin story, because.
Okay, there you go.
I essentially got run over by a truck on my 7th birthday. It smashed the whole side of my head in, and I was in a coma. I was gone for a while, the whole thing. Wow. And I was laid up where, for years, I couldn't do anything. I was like forced to be in bed, and it affected my equilibrium. Like, I still have weird problems with it, but like, I couldn't go out and play for a long time. I couldn't do all kinds of stuff. So a lot of the things I do creatively, which have become professional, were all a result of me being bedridden and my mother and my grandmother bringing me, because all the stuff I could do in bed was writing and drawing and playing guitar and singing and listening to music. So my grandmother would bring me a stack of comic books. My mom would bring me a stack of records. They gave me a guitar, and then they'd sit with me with these stacks of records and just put stuff on, and I'd listen and we'd talk about it. And like,
chills, that's love, man. That is
so
love.
You know, and then as you get old, and you know, I mean, you're a very accomplished musician and guitarist yourself. So, you know, like when you start out, you have that little kid logic. You don't have a catalyst for comparison. So, you know, I think it was a Lyle nylon string, and the action was like this high, and I'm, you know, I'm playing Smoke on the Water in the E string after like 6 months and thinking I'm the man. But just the process of that, of hearing these little tidbits, and then just by virtue of being kind of a captive audience, I'd stumble onto, oh my God, that sounds right. Or that's this, or I figured this out, or that process. To this day, I'm still completely taken with it the nuts and bolts of how to play something and how to write and how to craft and melody and harmony. And it's not bound to a genre, I think, or a state of mind. I don't think there's a genre of music that I don't feel like I get something from, or that I don't hear and that I'm not inspired by.
Right.
And then the guitar for me, aside from it being portable where I could lay in bed and play it, I think of all the because I play a couple different instruments, but the guitar is always the one I come back to, because I always felt it was the most intimate. Like I love the piano. I suck at it, but I love it.
Right.
But the thing about a piano is anyone who hits those keys is essentially hitting them the same way and producing the same. It's a cause and effect. Where guitar, the physicality of how you play, you can have 10 guitarists play exactly the same thing and they're all going to sound different, because there's a kind of an intangible nature of your fingers and the string and the wood and the humidity and the, and I just, there's something organic and really pure and simple about the guitar that I've just always been in love with. I love the guitar.
Interesting about you saying that, It's like, I feel like piano is a lot more subtle with the same kind of feel or vibe.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a lot more subtle. But guitar, it is also more versatile. I've seen people playing a guitar like a piano.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Literally put it like flat on their lap and they play it like they're tapping.
Check this out. I found these. Me and my wife moved a couple, not that long ago, and I found this stack of Van Halen photos from one of the first concerts I ever went to when I was a little kid.
That's awesome.
And I have a picture, and I have a copy of the patent where he actually invented this thing where he has this Lucite thing that came up, and he used to play it live like a piano.
That is so wild, dude. So it's
funny that you say that, because...
I mean, you don't see that very often, but that becomes like a signature of certain players, or like even playing it upside down. There's so many guys like Hendrix and the current guys, Eric Gales for me.
Dude, the thing is, Gales, good you know God. I
mean? Yeah.
Or Stevie Ray Vaughan, where he would whip it like back and forth. He'd take the back strap off and
And he would do it in time. He would do it in time.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That to me, it was like showmanship beyond.
You made a great point too, in the sense that of all the musical instruments, and again, this is just my opinion, but I mean, I've been playing my entire life, that guitar is the one you can weave through literally any genre of music, anything on earth, and you can find a place for the guitar in it.
Yeah.
And and at the end of the day, you got six strings, you got a 12-note repeating fretboard, and just the sheer variety, the sheer profound magnitude of players and sounds and genres and techniques that come out of those six strings and those 12 frets, I will be fascinated with. If I live to be 250 years old, I'll never get bored of that.
What I tell people is, like, guitar is like one of the easiest instruments to play and the hardest to master.
Oh, without a doubt. Because without a doubt.
You can just play like open chords or whatever, but it's like, that's not a level of mastery like Stevie Ray Vaughan or somebody when they're just playing these crazy solos and licks and just ideas are just like ridiculous. They're innovating the sound of the instrument. So
yeah, and even mastery is a relative term, because like if you bring up Stevie Ray Vaughan, Andre Segovia, Roy Clark, Van Halen, Steve Vai, like it goes on. It's Stanley Clark, Geddy Lee, Hendrix, Prince. But they are all masters, but it all manifests in a completely different way than each other. So you can master it as a country player and still have a whole universe of techniques that you haven't even touched on. Or you know, you get someone like Nile Rodgers, who has the funk chicken picking thing down and can play, but then he's not. And I just think that's fascinating. I really do.
And you also see like certain people like Nile Rodgers, you know, or like blues artists, where they pick like a certain thing and they become masters of it. But it's like, it's only like a couple little things that they're doing, but they do it so well that it just becomes signature. And like, that is mastery to like, you know, a ninth degree, because it's like, you know, you think you have less things to kind of do, so it'd be easier, but that's not the case. It's like,
oh no, absolutely.
It's harder to have a signature with less notes, or, you know, with blues guitars, I always feel like this, you know, there's only the pentatonic scale. Like, they're not doing a bunch of jazz licks.
And you got nothing to hide behind.
But yet you only have those notes to create a signature or create like a vibe of licks. And there's only a handful of players that really do that.
Albert King, BB King, Howlin' Wolf. Yep. Come on, man.
Yep. Freddie King, you know. Oh. I just saw this killing picture of Freddie. I'll have to text it to you. Freddie King and let me see if I can pull it up, because it's just so worth seeing and people are going to be curious about what it is. But I literally pulled this picture up today.
And it's there you go. Clapton, there you go.
And Freddie King, and you just see Freddie King wailing, and you see Clapton just in awe. You see him in awe of him, and I'm like, that's the blues to me right there. It's like,
yeah,
it's those are the masters. You know what I mean?
And again, you touched on another great part of guitar culture, is that I've always admired and respected the way that guitar players have a real profound respect for what came before. Yeah. There's a lineage that everyone really pays a lot of homage to, and you don't age out of it. Nobody cares. Like, if you get to that mountain, if you do something that resonates with the culture, people will be indebted and will, there's a part of you that, you know, again, like you were just showing that, I mean, Clapton's one of the most accomplished guitar players of all time, and he stands in awe of that guy.
That's what was so great about that picture. I'll probably post it later, but
yeah, that's wonderful, man.
That's such a cool picture because he's like, Freddie King is like the master, and then Clapton, who's like a master to me, is like in awe of his hero. It's like, does it ever end? Does it ever end?
Yeah.
We all have these heroes, you know. But let's get back to you. So, you know, when did you know? When was the moment of Zen? You're recovering from this accident. You're kind of doing all these creative things. You have a wonderful mother and grandmother, like giving you inspiration right there. What was the moment of Zen where you were like, I want to do nothing but this. This is it. I want to do this.
I think it's hard to pin down a single moment, but I remember distinctly there was a point early in high school, I'd say like the 8th or 9th grade, where I just started, it was like some switch got flipped and I started to really be able to, I don't know how to articulate, like a lot of stuff kind of opened up like a Russian puzzle box, like all the stuff I was listening to and I so desperately wanted to be good at it and wanted to feel some agency with, you know, instead of just fumbling with this thing and feeling like, you know, you know how it is, man, your fingers hurt and you get frustrated. And I remember distinctly, there was this very short period, could have been a week, could have been a month, where it all started to unfurl. Like I started going, oh, that sounds pretty good. Or, oh, that sounds pretty good. Or I'm able to play for 4 hours and my fingers don't hurt. Or, oh my God, I know how to play a Zeppelin riff. Or, oh my God, I know how to.
I still have those moments where when you learn something you love, you're like, oh my God, I learned this thing.
Exactly. And then I felt like there was I just fell so deeply in love with it. And then at the same time, you know, I mentioned my mom, but my mom was never a musician, but my mom had really, really great musical taste and she had a real passion for it. She still does. So she would just, it was like a no format radio station. Like we always had music on and she just play. It would be like just such an eclectic, you know, it would be like Miles Davis and then Stan Getz and then Led Zeppelin and then the Beatles and then Beethoven or Debussy. And then it would be, you know, and it was wonderful. And I'm really, 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 more than anything, I think I'm more grateful for that because I never felt it was compartmentalized. I never felt like, oh, well, this is off limits because this is genre or this is, I never made the distinction. And the 1-2 punch of being able to, having that stuff open itself up to me and then being so in love with so many kinds of music all at the same time, I was like, yeah, man, this speaks to something really deep and really profound that I don't ever want to be that far away from.
Right.
You know?
That's awesome. And I love that your mom was like showing you all that wide variety, that wide net of music. Because that never ends. It's like,
oh, and she still does that. She still calls me and she, you know, she's like, are you working on something? Do you want to send me something? Can I hear something? Or
that's awesome.
I heard this thing that reminded me of so-and-so, or, you know, she's like, oh my God, have you ever heard this version of Johnny Cash when he worked with Ruben? And I'm like, go mom.
It's so funny. I was talking to a friend of mine. You and I were texting about how I did that session with Dr. Fink.
Oh, come on, dude.
My buddy was like, I was like, yeah, man, I got to go pick him up at the airport. And he's like, dude, why wouldn't you just get an Uber to get him? And I was like, are you kidding me? That's the time where I get to have like no one else around and ask him questions about amazing experiences he had with Prince, which
brings
me to this next story. When I was taking him to the airport the next morning, he was telling me how cool, like this amazing story of him playing with Prince and Miles Davis. And Miles Davis,
God,
at Paisley Park. And he was just like, he was imitating Miles soloing. And he was like, man, it was such an incredible experience. And I was like, this is why I'm taking this guy to the airport right now. Because
you can't beat that, man. The mythology of it. And I met Prince once really briefly in Santa Monica at True Tone Music.
Oh, wow.
I have a buddy who owns a studio right around the corner from there. And I was recording, I broke a string and he knew the guys behind the counter. He's like, just run up, tell them it's for me. They'll give you a pack and run back. So I run in and I bust the door open because I'm in such a panic. And I immediately notice that there's nobody in the store. Nobody. Wow. And I'm looking around and then my eye catches something in the corner. And dude, it was Prince in a porcelain white tailored suit, and he's playing a big white Gretsch. And he was standing next to this chick who had these beautiful puffs, and she had an American flag vest on and white shorts and white go-go boots, and she was like a foot taller than him. She's standing next to him like mad dogging me when I came in, right? So immediately all that hit me at once, and I was like, I can't. Oh, God, what do I do? So I don't know if you've been to True Tone, but there's the big wall with all the guitars, and then there's like you go on the side, and then there's another room. So I kind of snuck in the side room. I was trying to be cool, but I'm such a huge Prince fan. I didn't want to make a complete ass of myself, which, to be honest, was probably too late at that point. So I went around, and I'm trying to be cool. I'm trying to be cool. I'm just picking up anything. I'm playing something. So I catch my breath, and I'm like, okay, how do I take an opportune moment to get my strings to get back to the studio? And then I become very aware of this thing behind me, and I turn around, and Prince is leaning against the door like this, watching me play. And he goes, so he turns back in, and I'm like an anime character, dude. I got like little hearts floating over my shoulders. I'm like, oh, it's Prince, you know? So I go back in the main room, and the guy came out, and he kind of pulled me aside, and he's like, hey, man, I'm sorry, we should have locked the door. He's like, you know, Prince, because he was doing that, he was doing like a month-long thing at the LA Forum. So he had rented a house here, and which I'd actually seen just a couple nights before this.
Wow.
So I was like, cool, man. I don't want to get in anybody's way. I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to intrude. He's like, no. He's like, take the strings. Tell your buddy I said hi. So as I'm leaving, I open the door, and I'm like, I'm never going to get this chance again. So I respectfully pull the door back, and I turn around, and I'm like, Mr. Prince. And he laughs, and he's like, it's just Prince. Because, you know, he's got that deep-ass voice.
Right.
And I'm like, look, I'm not trying to intrude. I'm not that guy. I don't want a picture. I said, I don't know if I'll ever have the opportunity to tell you this to your face, but I owe you a profound debt of gratitude. And the work that you've created has defined so much of what I do as a musician. And I just wanted to take the opportunity to tell you to your face, because I don't know if I ever have another chance. And he seemed genuine, because I mean, I work in Hollywood, man. Like, I have a pretty good barometer of who's just trying to, my bullshitometer is pretty good. And he seemed genuinely moved. And he reached out, and he's like, man, thank you for saying that. He's like, I'm really glad you took the opportunity to tell me. And he's like,
that's amazing.
And I'm like, dude, I'll leave you alone. And I said, but I did see you at the forum a couple nights ago. He said, what'd you think? And I said, I thought you kicked more ass than Mike Tyson on a meth binge. And he started laughing. And he's like, language. And I'm like, and then I said, well, I'll see you later. And he's like, all right, man. He's like, you keep doing your thing, man. And I said, well, you do too. And that was it. I ran back. Wow. And I was so excited when I got back. I was hyperventilating, and I'm like, my buddy at the studio is like, what the hell happened? He thought I'd been hit by a car or something. I'm like, and Chucho, and Prince, and it was Prince, and it was this girl, and it was a kid. And
who was the girl?
I don't know. I just some amazing like Amazon go-go dancer bodyguard that he was with.
I was
with
wondering him. If it was like a singer that he had in his band.
I don't think so. She looked, she could have been, but she was pretty formidable. I mean, he was a very little guy. She was like, I'm 6'3", so she was as tall as me. But it was, and you know, of course, because he's Prince, of course that girl was with him, because it was Tuesday. But
that's awesome.
That guy, man. And he did. And I felt like, you ever seen that like when Charlie Murphy used to do the Rick James, the True Hollywood Stories on the Chappelle Show?
Yep.
And he would talk about Rick James, how he had an aura around him. Prince was the same way, man. Like, I totally got this thing where seeing him up close, I'm like, dude, I can't. It was like someone was photoshopping him in real time. I'm like, I can't believe that you're a real human being, and that it was crazy.
Well, I met him once too, but we didn't have we had a nonverbal communication. I'll tell the story real quick, and I also told it on the session with Dr. Fink. But you know, I was watching P-Funk with some friends.
Nice.
And, you know, a friend of mine that worked at House of Blues was like, hey, I think Dr. Dre and Eminem are going to sit in with P-Funk. So I invited all my friends. We went out, and we were sitting there for like 2 hours, no Dr. Dre, no P-Funk. And she's like, hey, they're all upstairs, and they're all like partying in the dressing room. They're not going to come down. And I was like, all right, let me go tell my friends. So I told my friends, and they're like, all right, we're going to probably bail. It's about midnight. I'm like, okay, cool. So they left, and I was sitting there, and I was like kind of bummed. And, you know, it was like 20 plus years ago, because I was drinking at the time. I don't drink anymore.
Right.
But, you know, and I was sitting there, and I was like, all right, I should just get home, you know. So I'm about to walk out, and I hear all these whispers. It's Prince, it's Prince, it's Prince. And I see this guy come through. He was like 5'2", and he like whisked through the upstairs balcony area of the House of Blues, and all these security guys follow him. And I just literally walked in with his entourage. And, and like right in that moment that I walked in, all the security guards turned out. So they were looking out to make sure nobody came in, but I was already in with his entourage. So
that's great, man.
And I was like, you know what? I got to say something to him. And I was like, no, I don't say anything to him. I was like, so I stood next to him, and all of a sudden P-Funk starts playing Flashlight. And I know that song in and out. And so I start singing every lick that I could possibly sing. And I'm sitting right next to me, and he turns around and he looks and he starts smiling, and then he starts singing like under his breath. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, I got this reaction out of him. Then I was like, I gotta do something else. And I was like, I stood right next to him and I started moving a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And like he was looking at my feet, and then he's sitting down, he's dressed in all red, he had a popped red collar, a red suit. He had red, like, it looked like Disney heels, like a bow on the heels with little red pantyhose socks. I still remember his little two toes poking through. And he started moving his feet, and he was sitting. And I was like, all right, something in my head said, leave now. So I just gave him a nod and smiled, and he nodded at me and smiled. And then I left.
That's great, man.
I'd never seen him live. Fast forward to about a year later. And a friend of mine took me to see him live for the first time. And man, he was like,
it was unbelievable.
Doing the splits. He was like dancing his ass off, singing his ass off, playing lead guitar like I'd never heard. And I was so humbled. I was like, dude, I can't believe I did that. I felt so silly. And my buddy's like, yo, you're so quiet. Like, you're usually not this quiet. I was like, man, I keep thinking, like, what the hell was I thinking doing any of that? You know, like,
But man, he was all about the joy of it. You were, right. It was joyful, man. Right. You loved it.
But the thing was, had I seen him before, I never would have done that. But I'm glad I didn't see him until after. Real big piece of humble pie. But it also gave me that interaction that I probably never would have had without it. So that was my cool Prince story. But let's get back to you. So please. You're learning to play. Did you go to school for art and design to kind of learn storyboarding, or did you kind of like use the comic book influence and years of drawing to kind of get into that world before you branched into music? How did you kind of get into that?
Kind of a lot. So my dad and my mom split up when I was little, and my dad was a pretty successful commercial director in New York City.
Right.
So it was like one of those things where I'd go and see him a couple times a month, you know, and his life was very, very different than I grew up in Baltimore. So going from being like a poor street kid in Baltimore to like, you know, high class New York City was just a bit of a culture shock. But because I love comics and because I had been drawn so much, because again, I was like a captive audience for a long time. And I think I had a bit of facility for it just because my dad always drew and was an illustrator before he got into advertising. So when I'd go, and this is a weird, I don't want to disparage my dad because I loved him. And, I've grown to, my dad was not easy, and he was a complicated guy. We had a complicated relationship. And I don't think it's untrue to say, I don't think he was a great dad, but he was a brilliant guy and he was really good at what he did. And I learned a lot from him. But when I would go up and see him, he had his own agency. So he'd stick me with the guys in the bullpen because it wasn't like it is now. Back then you'd had like a crew of guys. That's all they did was storyboard. And then he'd be off banging Venezuelan models two at a time. And I'd be sitting with them, and it's all these old dudes with the suspenders and the Glenlivet and the cigar. And they're like, all right, kid, it's just like drawing Spider-Man, except it's a guy with a Pepsi. Go. Wow. And so all through high school, I would go and visit him. And that would be I would just spend time with all these old timers, and they would teach me like directorial theory and perspective and anatomy and all this kind of stuff. And then when I got into high school, early in high school, like ninth grade, I think I went into an advanced art program where they sent me, there was an offsite guy who did like, you know, where you did figure drawing and life drawing and that kind of stuff. And then I got my first comic assignment not that long after high school, maybe 2 years or so. And I was kind of straddling between doing comics and music, but ultimately music went out for a long time. And then I would do art jobs, whether it was storyboards or comics, to keep myself afloat while I was doing music stuff.
Right.
Excuse me. I got that tickle cough where I'm trying not to just blow right in the mic.
You can cough.
But yeah. And then it's weird because to this day, I still have a bit of that where I'm juggling chainsaws but back and forth between different creative pursuits. And I find that they're not as dissimilar as maybe I thought they were when I was a kid. I find that there's a lot of stuff creatively that, you know, one hand kind of washes the other. And I've always been grateful. But like I said, I think music, if I had to come back to one thing, I think that's the thing that resonates the most deeply.
Well, let's play a song. Let's play one of your songs. What do you want to play play us first? Your choice.
Okay, I guess Angelina. Angelina just is
All right, here's Angelina by Jeffrey Henderson.
Love me. She don't
Nice.
Thanks, man.
Tell me the inspiration behind the song.
How do I put this? Somebody that I was very close to decided that they needed to do their own thing at a time when I desperately needed someone to stay.
And I don't even mean it
like some harsh judgment. I just, you know, people make their own choices and we find our own way. And sometimes, you know,
sometimes it works out. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. It's weird. It's like, I love, like I was just petting my cat. I love animals. I like animals better than like people for the most part. Yeah. And the thing that, but the one thing that really sucks about loving animals and or pet ownership for anyone that bonds deeply with animals is the shelf life. Because ultimately 99 out of 100 times, you're always going to outlive them. Like their little lives are going to exist within yours. So knowing that ahead of time and you still do it. So it's like having that bond and having those experiences is worth knowing that that end is coming and how painful it's going to be. And my point is that just because the song is essentially just because something has a shelf life doesn't mean it's invalid or that it's not worthwhile.
Right.
You know, and that sometimes a thing can just be a thing for its own sake. And rather than lamenting what it should have been or could have been and isn't, it just is what it is. And that, you know, you move on.
I think about that almost every day because my bulldog's turning 9 tomorrow. And I'm like, man, it's been such a good 9 years. And it's also like, man, I don't want this to end. You know, he's healthy. He's good. But like, he's such a good boy. You know what I mean?
So and they all are, man. They all are.
Yeah. It's very true. So tell me, when you're writing music, do you start with the chords? Do you start with a riff? Do you start with a title? Like, what's your creative process?
It kind of depends. I mean, you had mentioned something earlier that to me is really on point with writing, in the sense that, you know, you're talking about how blues players, if you're just limiting what your repertoire to the pentatonic scale, you know, some people are dismissive. Oh, that's so simple. It's this. See, I think the opposite. I think there's a real bravery and honesty in having nowhere to hide.
Yeah.
It's much more difficult to take something simpler and make something really effective out of it than hiding, but not hiding. That sounds terrible, but you know what I mean? Like, I think the more you bring in
transparent, it's like,
exactly.
You can't fake it.
Exactly.
So as artists, you have to know the bag to know how to do it.
Yeah. I try to apply that a bit to writing too, where I try to keep things simpler because I'm more interested in a hook or a melody or than I am about showing off or proving to anyone what a great player I am. Like I kind of don't care about that. So usually I'll start with a chord or a progression or something that I'll just, cause I constantly have a guitar in my hand. So it'll, and I have like 1,000 things on my phone where I'm constantly recording. Oh, that's interesting. And I'll record it. And I'll usually record a couple weeks worth of stuff and not listen to it at all. And then I'll take one night, say every 2 weeks, and I'll go through all the stuff I've inventoried. And I have like a system with a series of exclamation points going from 1 to 5 to determine how cool I think it is.
Right.
So then I'll take the 5 ones and put them in a folder that's stuff that's actually worth working on or pursuing or developing. And sometimes it'll be a title or a phrase, or like I'll hear a particular turn of phrase that I think is interesting, or I'll hear something will catch my ear, or even sometimes you hear another song, like, oh, that's a really interesting turn, or that's a really interesting change, or whatever the thing is. But the vast majority of the time, it's just me sitting and riffing on something and humming, and I almost happen onto something, and I'll just record it, hoping that it doesn't suck. And then I'll collect it for a couple weeks and go back and sift through it. Cause I don't think, and once in a while I'll get something where I want to go down that rabbit hole right away. But a lot of times it'll be, you know, kind of an inopportune time. Like it's 3:30 in the morning and I'm watching Netflix ready to go to bed and something will hit me. And I'm like, man, I can't be up till 6 trying to flesh this out. So I just collect stuff like that. And that just works for me. And it's a little treat too. Like a couple times a month, I can actually really look forward to going through and kind of sifting through everything. Cause a lot of it, you just forget. Cause you can't. 10 seconds here, 30 seconds here, 50 seconds here. I'm like, oh, that was, you know, and then it's cool because some of the stuff like that I wrote off, like, oh, that wasn't really that interesting, is really cool. And then other stuff I was excited about at the time, I'm like, eh.
Isn't it weird how it definitely switches?
So
so jazzed about something and then you're like, huh, that's okay. And then you're like, oh man, this is gonna be awful. Okay, let me listen to this, and then you're like, actually, it's not so bad. It's, you know, yeah. So it's weird how that perspective kind of swaps sometimes.
And I think about I'm a huge fan of a lot of things, but I especially love we talked about Prince or the Beatles. I mean, I know that's a cliche with singer songwriters, but it's a cliche for a reason, I would say. Right. But one of the things that always stuck with me about writing is I read an interview with McCartney a long time ago that really stuck with me, where he was talking about that people mythologize the Beatles process more than they did, that right. there's like this reverence and people attach all this stuff to it. And he's like, you know, to us, we just would show up. It was like not work in the sense that it was drudgery, but he's like, we just looked at it like, okay, this is what we do every day. You go in and you finish a song, and you just do the work. You just keep showing up. And he's like, it's a numbers game. So, and I try to keep that in mind too. I try really hard not to get too precious about it right. and too up my own ass about it. Like, I think there's a real value in just doing it, getting it done, letting it go, moving on. I try not to belabor the point or obsess about stuff too much or like deconstruct it. And you know, you're a really accomplished writer too, man. Every now and then you'll get that one that takes a while to crack or you go back and revisit. But for the most part, as a baseline, for the most part, I kind of do stuff and I might make a few tweaks, but like I try to leave it as it is. And I would rather write a new song or put the time into something else rather than spending the same time I could finish five songs obsessing over one.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the part of it is like there's, you know, from the Paul McCartney, John Lennon thing, somebody was asking them, they're like, you know, what is it like to be a Beatle? You know, one of them said like, it's just me writing a song with my mates, you know? And it's like, it's just them playing music with their friends. And like in the same way that we play with, you know, our friends and
absolutely
creating something that is special, but you know, it's not revered in the same way because it's a different time. There's, you know, there was only certain amounts of media. Now there's media everywhere.
Well, and their body of work was so singularly amazing, dude.
Like, amazing, yeah.
I mean, people forget their whole body of work was like 7 years, which is insane. Like now that's the amount of time between records for some people. But
yeah, and also like the diversity in style and like how they evolve from record to record as far as songwriters or artists or singers or musicians. Guitar, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, they're definitely like one of the most iconic. I got to meet Paul McCartney in the studio once.
Oh,
to
stop!
In another time, we'll have to talk about that. Stop but I mean, it. But you know, it's like you watch them, and they're still trying to tap into the same thing that we are. Like they're
absolutely
trying to write something. They're just trying to like create something, and a lot of it is, you know, oh, this time it worked, and the next time it may not, and then the next time it will. I mean. I was in the studio with Paul McCartney when he was doing Chaos and Creation in the backyard, and I was like watching. I got to watch him do like guitar overdubs and bass overdubs and
wow.
some other stuff. But the crazy thing is, I read an article about him doing this process, and like he'd be like sitting at the bass all jazz, and Nigel, his producer, would be like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, I'm gonna track bass today." And he's like, "No, you're not gonna track bass today." He was like always trying to throw him off his game, and he said he would just be like so bummed, you know, and it's like that happens in the studio for everybody, even a Beatle, you know what I mean? So sometimes, you know, it's you're trying to capture something and it's not working, or sometimes you have plans to do track something and it's not going to happen that day. It's going to happen another day. So it just
absolutely
sometimes, you know.
And I think there's a shared literacy. I think that musicians who have a deep passion for that stuff recognize that passion in other musicians,
right?
You know. Yeah. And again, I think it jumps genre. I think it jumps generations. I think that it's so fundamental that when that thing gets hold of you, you instinctively, you can recognize it in other people. And like McCartney, I mean, that's a great example because to me, I find that very reassuring. If someone that accomplished is still struggling, not struggling, but still dealing with the same back and forth that I do.
It's exactly it. They are,
you know,
And that's the thing that it's like, you know, you don't think about it like that because you're like, oh, it's Paul McCartney. But no, he's still trying to capture.
Felt that way about Elvis and Cliff Gallup and all those people and on and on and on. And Chuck Berry and Little Richard and all the blues guys. And it goes on and on. It's crazy how I had a buddy super quick who escorted McCartney to Grammy show years ago.
Oh, that's cool.
And she was telling me that as she was walking him, that he saw B.B. King coming towards him. And she said it's like he got like where he was like a 12-year-old where he's like, you think you could introduce me to B.B. King? And she's like, yeah, Mr. Paul McCartney, I think he'd be cool with that. But she said it was really funny because you saw this guy who's such an icon revert back to that starry-eyed fan thing. And it, you know, and if you're in touch with that, you know, because some people, it becomes more about ego or it becomes more about validation. But I mean, if you're talking strictly for the love of something or the inspiration of something, I don't think that ever goes away. I think that's wonderful. I think that's really amazing. You know, my wife used to co-host a show with Stan Lee before he passed.
Wow. That's amazing.
She's a huge, huge, like, pop culture journalist, huge like professional comic nerd. But I remember when I met him one time and I thought I was gonna just totally break down, man, because he created work like that. It's why where a lot of my reverence for the Beatles comes from, because when I was a kid, I mean, those were some of the only safe places I had to go. Right. I mean, for real. And I don't mean it figuratively, I mean and I just to have him right there, and he was so sweet, and he was so lovely, and I just, you know, and I'm like, I don't know how to thank you, and he's like, oh, come on now, it's fine, and I'm grateful, like I'm not embarrassed by that. I think that's wonderful, man. I don't want to lose that. I'm very grateful that I feel
that. Notice like the people that are the creators like that too. They're just so kind. They're just like so soulful. They have that grace or humanity about them that's on a different level, you know. So I think that's why they're able to create the things that they are, you know? So let's play something else. What are you going to play next?
I'll say High Tonight.
Okay. Here's High Tonight.
It's kind of a, I don't know. It's kind of a cheap trick riff.
Okay, cool. Here's High Tonight by Jeffrey Anderson.
And I'm headed for disaster. I can feel it in my bones. And we chase the love we're after. We're better off alone.
Cool. Very pop rock, very kind of like alternative influences, a little bit of country rock too. Tell me, like, what was the inspiration behind it?
I don't know. That was more one of the, I'd had a couple different parts sitting around, and sometimes, I mean, again, this is just me. I don't know. Maybe you do this, maybe you don't. But like, if you have parts of songs, like, man, this would be so cool if I could find a place for this. Man, this would be so cool if I could find a place for this.
Put them together.
Yeah, and then sometimes you kind of do. So I had the headed out, some headed for disaster part, and then I had the wow part, and then I was talking to a buddy of mine, and I said, "What are you doing tonight?" He said, "Oh, I'm going to be high tonight." I'm like, well, that's no kind of answer. What does that mean? He's like, I'm just going to stay home and get high. I'm like, all right, so I guess I'm not seeing you then. But then it stuck with me. And then for some reason, that kind of brought the whole thing together. And I just, it was, you know, and there was something about that phrase that kind of brought, because I'd goofed around with it and I had another thing, but it wasn't really working. And then the minute he said that, I was like, oh my God. And it just, the minute he said it, I had a melody for the chorus and that kind of brought the whole thing together.
That's so funny. You know, it's funny how songs can come out of like thin air, and it can come from a conversation. It can come from a moment. It can come from a word that you see. It's like, it just, you never know what the inspiration is going to be. You just have to stay open as much as possible. And it's like,
yeah,
where am I going to draw from today? You know?
Yeah, exactly. And I also thought it was fun doing, like I said, I have a huge, a deep love of, you know, like, I don't know, like pop rock bands like Cheap Trick and The Cars and Oasis and Blur and people like that. And,
yeah, I had that like pop rock vibe for sure.
Yeah, I love that stuff. So, you know, and I'm not so presumptuous as to assume it's there, but that was that was at least the intention. Cool.
I mean, you hear it. I mean, it's got the elements. It definitely has the elements of all of that. So I can tell what you love by that. By the way, what kind of guitar is that in the middle? I see an electric guitar. Is that a Schecter? What is that?
Oh, no. Oh, hold on a second.
Oh, it's a Dan Electro.
Yeah, it's a baritone.
Oh, that's cool. I was like looking at that guitar. I'm like, what is that? Like,
yeah, I've got a, I don't know.
No, it's not an Ibanez.
Yeah, and I always, this is one of my favorite guitar designs, just aesthetically of all time. I think that is so badass, just aesthetically. And then here, I'll show you a couple of the other ones. This is one I just finished that I'm.
Oh, that's cool. That's
kind of like, cool. You know, my 80s throwback.
Is there a lightning bolt on it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's super cool, man. I love that. That's super cool.
And then this one is another one kind of like that, which is another one.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
The Iceman. Like, I always love this body style. I don't know about the Freddie Mercury 70s era Harlequin thing.
Oh, I
think
that.
It's cool.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I like the three singles, and it's got 22 frets instead of 22.
Oh, wow.
And it doesn't have a trem, which is weird because I use a trem all the time, but.
And then, how's the weight distribution? Is it weird to hold it or no?
No, it's great. And the one requisite that I have with all my guitars is I want them light. They're all like between 6.5 and 7 pounds. And then this is my main one, which is the Strat.
That's awesome.
And this is, I cobbled this together, but this one, like, yeah, this is like my right arm. And that's my cat Peanut on the.
That's on the awesome. Oh, I'm going to do that. I'm going to have to do that. How did you do that, by the way?
There's a guy on eBay. It was like $10 to like laser etch it. I can send you the link.
Oh, send me the link, man. I need to have a picture of Otis on my guitar for sure. Yeah, what is it? A sticker or what?
It's here. And then this is my old cat Biscuit that died. That I have on my telly.
Oh, that's awesome. See? I love that.
So they laser etch it onto there.
That is super super cool.
And then this one just beat to hell, but I love this one too.
That is awesome.
So
let's play something else before we run out of time. What's the name of the last song?
So real quick, this one's called Absent Friends. And this is, of all the songs I have, this is probably the one that means the most to me.
Okay.
Years ago, I lost my dad and my brother back to back.
Oh, man.
When a very short period of time.
Right.
And my brother, I don't have the words. The day of his funeral was the worst day of my entire life.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
It was just horrible for my family. And we came back to L.A., and I was just so lost and kind of destroyed. I came in, grabbed a beer, I lit a joint, I picked up that Hummingbird and wrote this song about 85% as you're going to hear it, which has never happened to me before or since.
Wow.
The whole thing in like one sitting. I think I changed part of it.
I got chills, bro.
But yeah, so, and I mean, you of all people, cause I know you're a writer too. I think you'll appreciate, but yeah, it's the only time it's ever happened to me in my whole life.
Well, let's hear it. Here's Absent Friends by Jeffrey Henderson.
Your eyes are like a window to the ocean, like the words to a sad, sad song I'll never
question. Are you a fan of Adam Schlesinger? Do you know that the songwriter? You got a very similar style of writing to him.
Really?
He's the songwriter that wrote all the songs from that movie, That Thing You Do.
Yeah. Somebody else just mentioned that like 2 weeks ago.
So it's very much in that bag. It's very cool. He's also, he was in a band called Fountains of Wayne.
But, oh, okay.
Terrific pop rock writer. Like one of the best. And
well, thanks for that, man. That's a wonderful compliment.
You should check out his music because you have.
I'll do that. I just wrote it down. Thank you.
He's got a lot of the same like rock influences, blues, Americana, kind of pop. It's all in that same bag. So you will definitely benefit from just listening to his stuff because very similar parallel styles.
I really appreciate it, man. That's very gracious of you. So yeah.
Let me ask you, who are some of your biggest heroes? You mentioned Prince, Beatles. As far as songwriters or influences, who are some of your biggest influences or as a player or as a writer?
As a player, Prince is definitely at the top. I'd say Van Halen. But even less about lead stuff than rhythm. I don't think he gets enough credit as a rhythm player.
Because he
was a funky dude, man. Like some of the riffs and the rhythm patterns, to me, it was all about his right hand. His left hand gets all the attention, but I always thought Pete Townsend, for the same reason, I thought he was a phenomenal, phenomenal rhythm player.
All the players I love, David Gilmour's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
They're all terrific rhythm players.
Oh, yeah.
Rip on solos. And you usually find the guys that are ripping like crazy solos aren't always the best rhythm players.
Yeah.
As all are. It's like Steve Ray Vaughan's like one of mine. And like,
and Vaughn, too. I mean, or Hendrix. I mean,
Hendrix, yeah.
Again, like a lot of the cliches are cliches for a reason because the influence that these people had were so tremendous. But, I don't know, man. There's very few people I've ever listened to. Like when I was little, my dad grew up in rural Georgia and knew Jerry Reed.
Oh,
remember
wow.
him? Yeah. And I met with him a couple times. He gave me a couple lessons when I was a kid, and he was a total character. And I take away from almost everyone I've ever heard. Like I feel like I can take something, and I just love the guitar, and I love people that play the guitar, and I love the culture of the guitar.
Right.
And the other thing is, like, I like hip hop a lot, and I wish that we talked about things being compartmentalized earlier. I wish people would let go of some of the genre boundaries a little bit, because I feel like, let me think of a good example. Like, you know, the song, what's it called? Humble by Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know
that
song?
Yep.
Dude, if you play that with a guitar, it's a Black Sabbath riff. Or like California Love, like there's so much great riff. I think there's so much more shared DNA in a lot of popular genres than people think. And I really try to stay out of like separating them that way. So like there's so many people that I love, and there's so many people whose work that I'm like deeply inspired by. You know, some are well known. Some people like there was a band when I was growing up called Crack the Sky. They were huge in Baltimore. I didn't even know they weren't like Led Zeppelin until I left Baltimore. That's how they were huge. And their guitar player and their writer were a huge influence when I was a little kid. And then people like Pickett, like Tor Wilson Pickett when I was a kid. And like that was phenomenal. Just that whole thing getting thrown into that. And, I could go on and on, but we'd be here for like 4 days. Or like a lot of the contemporary guys, like you said, like Eric Gales is, dude, the guy is phenomenal. Just like he's so good. Like sometimes I watch clips of him and I'm like, man, I should just go open a damn shoe store. Like,
That's how it is. Real quick, before we run out of time, where can people find you online if they want to find your music or find you to storyboard something? Where can people
I everything I do is under planethenderson.com, and I'm going to kind of do a big relaunch with music stuff after the new year, because I've just haven't had great luck releasing stuff between the pandemic and some of the other stuff that was going on.
Right.
Like I did an EP and we had this big fresh release party like 2 weeks before everything got shut down. It was So I've just been stockpiling stuff. So, that's where it all starts. Everything goes back to planethenderson.com.
Well, and I'll be the first to announce it here. You're going to be on my Songwriter in the Round in January 9th, 9 p.m. at Hotel Cafe. So that'll be probably the next show that you play.
We are going to burn that place down, my friend.
Keep it up.
Wait. It's
going to be fun. But on behalf of myself, Jeffrey Henderson, and Sam, we're going to sign out. Thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood, Jeffrey. We're going to have you back, too. So keep drawing, keep playing music, keep writing songs, keep on the rock and roll lifestyle, because that's what it's all about.
Thanks, brother.
On behalf of Jeffrey, Sam, myself, happy holidays. This is the last show before Christmas, but not the last show of the year. So happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah.
All Merry that Christmas. Merry, happy holidays, everyone.
Yeah, happy holidays.
And Nikki, thank you so much, man.
Of course, of course. Thank you so much, Jeffrey. We'll see you in a couple weeks, and everybody, will see you next week. Peace and love. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Happy holidays. We out.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.